The most exciting thing I think that's happened recently is the term AI slop, because that was to me this cultural nomenclature of a rejection of a universal sameness that people were seeing. That doesn't mean AI bad, human good. It means AI is not anything inherently. It's not good or bad. It's not going to lead to better or worse. It has no view on what it's going to do. It's just this technology. So if you take something like content or creativity, it's both. It's very good in terms of how it liberates access to creative ability. Now, if everyone can do that, you can end up with a notion of sameness. And what are humans going to do? We're going to reject that.
Running a business means solving problems. I tell you how the smartest entrepreneurs do it. Hi, I'm Jason Pfeiffer, editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, and this is Problem Solvers. I have this theory about what AI is. I think that AI is a microwave oven. What do I mean by that? Here it is. Okay, so a microwave oven is incredible technology, and it is in everyone's homes. And it's mind-blowing, right? I mean, try to explain a microwave oven to someone from 100 years ago. You can't. It's amazing. But we don't cook every meal in the microwave. You know why? It's because we've had decades to experiment with what belongs in the microwave and what doesn't. And we've learned that putting pizza in the microwave to reheat it, fantastic. Making a steak dinner in the microwave, not so good. We only know that because we stuck both of them in the microwave and we saw what it did and we learned. And the reason why I say AI is a microwave oven is because I think that that is the experience we will eventually have with AI too. At some point, we will know what this technology is really good for and what this technology actually turns out to not be that good for. But we don't know that right now because it's so new. So we're just sticking everything in the microwave. Everything's going in the microwave and we're trying it all out. And culturally, the mistake that we make is that we see somebody try something. They put it in the microwave. AI is now going to do this. Somebody launched a thing and AI is now going to do all HR or whatever it is. And then we say, oh my God, well, that's the end of HR. That's the end of this. Everything is going to change. And we don't understand that actually we're just looking at experiments and we haven't had it long enough to see what the actual experiments bear. So with that, boy, do people talk about this as a thing that is shaping entrepreneurship. AI, entrepreneurship is going to change radically because of AI. Entrepreneurship already has changed. Entrepreneurship is never going to be the same. Is that true? What is AI actually going to do to entrepreneurship? What is it going to do for you building a business? Well, I have someone who has as good a perspective on that as anyone can. His name is Anish Raman. He is the, and this is the coolest title I've ever heard, the Chief Economic Opportunity Officer at LinkedIn and the author of the book, Open to Work, How to Get Ahead in the Age of AI. Anish, you are able to draw on real world, real time insights from over 1.3 billion LinkedIn members and get a clear eyed view of what's actually changing in the world of entrepreneurship. I am so excited for you to break that down for me on Problem Solvers. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Anish, first, why write the book? Open to Work, How AI is Changing. One could say, well, it's because AI is changing everything. One could also say, it's so early, how could we possibly know?
Yeah, I mean, going to your microwave example, I think what's powerful about LinkedIn is it's a bunch of people trying to figure this out together. I mean, the best way to understand LinkedIn is it's the largest network of professionals ever assembled, and we have it in place as we go through what I think will be the greatest disruption to work in human history. And so what we were noticing on LinkedIn, both in terms of the conversations people were having, but also the skills people were adding, the tasks that were getting updated on job descriptions, was the beginnings of like figuring out like, okay, what is this? And what do we use it for? And what do we not use it for? And so we recognized that in the day-to-day of LinkedIn, there was this sort of learning process that was happening. But when you look outside and you look at the headlines and you look at the conversations happening about AI and work, it's also charged. It's so emotional. Mm-hmm. It's fueling so much fear and anxiety. And I think worst of all to Ryan, my co-author and I, it's fueling this fatalism. It's fueling the sense that everything is predetermined, that AI knows what's going to happen to us as individual workers or businesses, that CEOs of the big businesses know, academics know, the latest prediction knows, but we have no agency, we have no control, we're just along for the ride. And if you remember those early days of AI, and it still lingers, was this idea that the ride is done. Mm-hmm. Humans, we had a good run, AI is going to beat us at everything, if not already soon. Like, let's call it. Yeah. And we're like, no, that's not right. That's not how this works. That's not how it's ever worked. If you look across human history, like, we decide what we're going to do with these things as we invent them. If you look at the human brain, as we do in the book, which is far older than any of the industrial revolution inventions, from the steam engine to AI. And I think the most complex and incredible object in the known universe, the human brain, it knows how to do cool stuff. Like, it knows how to help us imagine, invent, to create civilizations, the monetary order, like all this stuff that came before the steam engine. And so we really wrote this book to help people like get that. And so the book is really meant to at least move whoever's feeling anxious to a place of agency. And then whoever's feeling agency is there to be had, to a place of aspiration. Because our whole sort of thesis is that work is changing, not ending.
You are speaking my language, man, for a number of reasons. Number one, I am absolutely obsessed. I'm a history nerd, and I'm absolutely obsessed with how we have interacted with technology over time. And the recurring theme is that we have some kind of new technology, and then we make absolutely hysterical predictions about how this new technology is going to radically change the fundamental humanness of us. And of course, then it never does that. Instead, it gets integrated as a new tool that we can use. And almost always, it never even replaces the old tool. It just comes and lives alongside it. So for example, cars didn't replace bicycles. We have both of them, but now we have them in different ways. The internet didn't replace the phone. We're just using them in different ways. And there's always this talk of the human brain cannot process this. The human brain is just it's just an adaptability machine. And so everything that you're saying here is spot on. So, okay, let's talk about then.
But the one thing I would say that was sort of the biggest revelation as we were reporting this book, mm-hmm. was everything you said is right. And yet I think we've had a false story as humans that we somehow left the industrial age when we entered the knowledge economy, that all mm-hmm. the work that we can look back now and think about, factory work. In the book, we talk about knocker uppers, people whose job it was to go with like literal pea shooting sticks and wake people up before alarm clocks. Like, oh my God, all of that work, obviously like not about human capability. That's machine-like work. But then we came to this enlightened knowledge economy, and we were all doing in white collar jobs, this thinking work, this imagining work. And really, as we looked at the data, so much of white collar work in the knowledge economy has been work about work. It has been factory work, assembly line work of a different form. We've all been just doing more, better, faster, more, better, faster. And so what we realized was really what the industrial age has done has been forcing us to build a story of work around the technology, not around human capability. And we've all become more machine-like as we've supported the new IT machines of our time to deliver more efficiency around the production of goods and services. And so that all was sort of like what made sense in that world of industrial work and the role of humans. And that's how you get the org chart and the career ladder and all the stuff. But what AI offers is this complete upending event, because now machines are going to out-machine us. So what the work becomes for humans isn't machine-like work supporting machines. It's not being AI prompters as the sole rationale for existence. It really pulls at this cord of what is economic growth. Economic growth is partly efficiency of production, but also it's ease of innovation. How easy is it for economies and organizations and individuals to come up with new ideas in ways only humans can and go do something big with those ideas? Well, it used to be very few humans had big ideas. Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, Steve Jobs, like, and we talk about in the book, the lost Einsteins, the degree to which your socioeconomic status set you up.
Abercrombie knows denim better than anyone. Their relaxed jean was made for everyday plans, while their baggy jean comes through for the days you need something different. Plus, they've got their original classic fits and athletic fits for guys who want a little more room in the fire and seat. Shop Abercrombie Denim and more in the app, online, and in stores.
Up or not to be one of those big idea inventors. But they would come up with a big idea, and then a bunch of humans would come and just execute that idea. So even in the knowledge economy, you had, you know, startups emerge from garages and become multinational corporations, but only a few people had the ideas. It was large amounts of coders and managers just executing efficiency against those ideas in the production of goods and services. Now we're saying, well, no, like everyone's going to be entrepreneurial and come up with ideas and be innovative at every level. Some people less than others, some people on their own as business builders, others within companies. But like the core job of the human at work is going to be to imagine, to invent, to push, to prod, to, as we have in the book, a definition from Paul Cheek at MIT, to do more than is reasonable with the resources you have. So it's not to execute the existing playbook and the way things have always been. It's to try something new and try a way that's never been before. The industrial age, which is only 300 years old, has dramatically shrunken who we think we are and what we're capable of against the human brain, which is in its ability for a complex thought that we have today, go to Sapiens to read about it, is at least 40 to 70,000 years old. And I would say the one class of human that has preserved their humanity against the machineries of the industrial age is the entrepreneur. And I think that's why like your audience and everything that you're about is so instructive, not just in terms of the enormous upside for people to start businesses right now. It's never been less costly, easier, and more competitively differentiated for someone to do. But what you can inspire all workers across all stages of career in every sector so that they can think more like you all think and be more entrepreneurial in the ways of work.
Man, that is inspiring. So let's take that down to a practical, actionable level. You're being heard right now. The Problem Solvers listenership is an entrepreneur listenership. These are people who aspire to build businesses or they are building businesses right now. And I am sure that they are trying to figure out how to integrate AI into their work. They are maybe worried if AI is going to radically change the way in which they're doing their work. How should they be thinking differently and maybe even recognizing new opportunities right now?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is, what is AI doing? What do I need to do with AI? What do I not know that I need to know? Like what's amazing about this moment, and we anchor on this in the book, is that you want to start with the strengths you have as a human, as an individual, and then start to realize the things you don't need to do anymore because old work is going away. AI is going to completely take away old work, the drudgery work, the efficiency work, but it's also going to upend the systems of old work in a really democratizing way. So what does that mean for you? If you were starting a business right now, you know what? You don't need access to a huge amount of capital anymore. You don't need to build a huge team and have 6 months to test an idea because now you can like research a market, build a prototype, launch a landing page in a weekend. Like you could just do it. It's really about, is my idea worthy of it? How do I test and try it? What do I build around it? So the cost of starting has collapsed like dramatically. So you start from a place of like, okay, that's liberating, but also, oh my God, anyone can start a business now. So you're really inching towards a battle of ideas and execution in a different way. Before, which was very limiting, it was a battle of credentials and capital. Like, could you get the resources to back your even testing of an idea? That's all getting upended. Now it's a battle of ideas and execution that anyone can be part of. You look at the creator economy, you look at Gen Z with multiple income streams, you look at more and more people coming up with side hustles that become their like full-time job. Like the arena of business building is already starting to get really permeable. So you have to recognize what you don't have to do anymore, but what you do need to do is have a really good idea. Like you're not going to get away with an okay idea, but you get the capital through the credentials to be out there before others. So that's where the tools help too. Like pressure test your idea, push on something that's unique. In the book, we have a chapter called Nobody Beats You at Being You. And I think that's always been true for entrepreneurialism and entrepreneurs, but more than ever before, like the idea for the business you want to build, it can't just be like a problem you've identified the market has because other people could identify that problem and everyone now has the ability to go after it. It's the problem you've identified and something unique about your lived or learned experience or just about who you are that will drive you to go at that problem in a way no one else will. Because that'll motivate you, but it'll also become part of your like competitive edge when you talk about it. So I think that's like the most important actionable thing is like, if you're an entrepreneur more than anyone else, every day you should be doing something new. Doing something new with AI, that means task it with something new, try a new tool than the ones you've been using, but also doing something new around your human capability, which you have going as an entrepreneur. But in the book, we talk about these five C's: curiosity, compassion, creativity, courage, communication. We talk about these habits, adaptability, resilience. You got to be pushing yourself in all of those. You got to be more uncomfortable about courage one day, more uncomfortable about how you're communicating one day. You got to be finding ways to build resiliency, adaptability. And then ultimately, you're trying to build a business case now that is as much about you as it is your product. Because whatever is the question you're trying to answer, the problem you're trying to solve, you need to start really articulating why are you individually uniquely positioned to go after it, which is about your motivation and your curiosity and sort of your know-how, not just because of my pedigree signals, I'm able to get the capital needed to be able to actually hire the team that'll build the prototype that'll test it. That model is done.
You know, it's funny. I posted this thing that I'm going to tell you about on LinkedIn, so it feels very appropriate, yesterday, not even thinking about how relevant this could be to our conversation today. But I want to share it with you because I want to hear you react to and maybe unpack the conclusion that I came to from it. So this started because I got a pitch. You know, people run a magazine, you get pitches 30,000 times a day. And this one, the subject line of the email was not written in ChatGPT. And then the pitch, which was ultimately, you know, about would I write about this person, began like this. Hi, Jason. Thought you might want to read an actual email without any help from AI, all grammatically incorrect with errors and all. And, you know, I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. I actually have seen a lot of email in my inbox that is like that, very specifically calling out that they didn't use AI to write it. And what it got me thinking was that we're on a kind of interesting, distinct moment where I'm not using AI, at least in some form of communication, is by itself some kind of differentiator. I'm thinking about, for example, how many ads show up online now that are intentionally incredibly ugly. And I think the reason for that is because they stand out in contrast to very pretty things that AI can produce. And what I wrote was, I said, you know, the I'm not using AI flex won't last forever, but for now, AI has allowed human connection to feel like a competitive advantage. And that's because it's worth remembering every action prompts a counter reaction. Every moving crowd leaves white space behind. And this got a really, really strong reaction, 227,000 impressions as we speak. And that is not a screed against AI, but it is me pointing out that there is a distinct value in finding the most human part of the thing that you do or the way that you relate to people and leaning in on that as a competitive advantage. And what you were saying before really reminded me of that, where you're telling people essentially, look, these tools are amazing. You should use them. But also what they're going to do right now is they're going to rely upon and succeed because of your distinct humanness. So I'd love to hear you talk about how people should think about humanness as a competitive advantage and how to use it inside of an AI world.
Yeah, I mean, your microwave example is so good because I think if you sort of start from a place that we are very early in an entirely new era for work and for the economy, I think it's an era that will produce a new theory of work, a new theory of human capability. Like we're at the start of something really big in the course of human history, but we're just at the start. And understandably, because we're coming out of the industrial age, everything is about the new technology of the day. And everything is about how do we just do stuff with it to do more of what it can do better? Because that's how it worked with the steam engine. It's how it worked with electricity. It's how it worked with the internet. But we're really early. We're in like the dial-up days of internet. So for us to go so far so fast, you're going to miss the plot. And the thing that I think we've missed the plot on over the past few years is that humans matter. Like humans are awesome. Humans matter. I'm radically pro-human. And so what that means is like, we're going to react to all this as it plays out. Like the diffusion of AI is contingent upon human societies figuring out what they feel and what they want to do about it. It isn't simply about the capability of the technology. And as it gets better, it diffuses more. So like you just said, you know, the most exciting thing I think that's happened recently is the term AI slop, because that was to me this cultural nomenclature of a rejection of a universal sameness that people were seeing where AI made it possible for everyone to now create and to provide content and to write. Now, that doesn't mean AI bad, human good. It means AI is not anything inherently. It's not good or bad. It's not going to lead to better or worse. It has no view on what it's going to do. It's just this technology. So if you take something like content or creativity, It's both. It's very good in terms of how it liberates access to creative ability. Now, if everyone can do that, you could end up with a notion of sameness. And what are humans going to do? We're going to reject that with a term like AI slop. So now the floor goes up. Like, anyone can now be creative, but so does the ceiling. Because like, what we want to be true creative that'll break through has to be authentic. And then you have people like Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese talking about taste. And this idea that taste is this like undefinable for AI thing about how humans feel about stuff you're putting out there. So right now we're like early in this experimentation. I think that people are underusing or overusing AI. No one, everyone's finding their way to the right use. Underuse is like, you either don't use it or you use it as a new search. You just like ask the thing you'd ask Google and have AI give you a more comprehensive answer. And then overusing is like, you've removed your mind from the equation of work and you're just giving AI everything and just doing whatever AI says. Like, both of those extremes aren't getting the value of this. The middle is like, how you use AI to start to be the best version of yourself that is competitively differentiated. So I'll just like end with me as an example, because I've lived all this. You know, my career makes absolutely no sense by job title. I'm like a war correspondent at CNN who becomes a speechwriter to President Obama, who then does growth at a couple of startups, who then goes to Facebook around economic impact, senior advisor to the California governor on economic strategy, now at LinkedIn, and a cool job that got made up by my co-author, our CEO, like a few years ago, with the idea of like, go figure out what this job is and go do something with it. Well, like, why did we make that job up? Because if you put my titles aside, but you look at like my skills, which I did as I went through my LinkedIn profile early in my LinkedIn time, like, I know how to do explanatory storytelling. That's kind of what I've done from my like first days as a reporter to this conversation. When I left journalism, I didn't want to just tell stories. I wanted to mobilize action around it. So like, coalition building becomes a skill set. That's helpful for business development and growth as well as policy advocacy. And then I like fell in love with this issue of economic opportunity. It's economic agency, economic mobility. Martin Luther King talks about it as economic freedom. Just like the brokenness of the labor market, which I think is one of the least transparent, least efficient, least dynamic markets humans have ever created. The brokenness of how people like access opportunity and mobility. Like, I'm just going to figure this thing out. And then AI hit and it was like, oh, I've got this skill set. We've got this societal problem. So we created this role to go shape the global conversation around it. Now, I used AI to help get really smart, really quick at new things like management science, behavioral economics. Like, I read books like Flow and Peak and Emotional Intelligence, but AI was like my sparring partner and all that. As we thought about a book, it could help us like structure it and test it. But what landed it was the human to human stuff. It was like Ryan and I debating the things that were in there. And with AI freeing up time from the first draft that I would do on writing, I spent more time doing this, like studying what is it to be human to human and land a persuasive argument. So I went to like every performance I could for a bit, every Broadway show, every concert. I wanted to look at the masters of like in-person human energy creation. Like, how do they do that? And I learned a ton, like the power of the pause, the way that you build a story. So I'm an example of like, I'm still figuring it out. Every day I feel behind. Every day I'm using AI in different ways because I'm constantly in that experimenting of in between under and overuse. But the whole bet is that I'm about to find what's unique to me and my human capability that AI is going to help me do at a supercharged level that's going to give me greater agency and greater value in the work I do.
Man, Anish Raman, the book is called Open to Work, How to Get Ahead in the Age of AI. Final question. Do you think if you crack this book open 10 years from now that in this moment you could have possibly anticipated where we will be in 10 years? Like how relevant is the conversations that even the smartest people like you are able to have about AI today? How confident do you feel like we really know where we're going and that we know what we're doing?
So when we were going to write a book, we knew we were writing ahead of the publication of something that would be around for a while. So that's like a just 2-year process right there. And the early bet we made was we're not going to write a book about AI. That is going to be dated the minute it's published. This thing is changing so dramatically, so quickly. We have no idea what's coming tomorrow. What we're going to do is write a book about how to human with AI. And we're going to spend most of the book on the human part. And humans have been around for millennia, evolving. Like, we don't evolve as quickly as AI's capabilities are expanding. And a lot of what we know about what makes us us is durable. What we need to do urgently now is actually redesign the systems of work, of education, employment, and entrepreneurship around these very durable human strengths with an ever-evolving view of how AI plays into that. So like now we kind of like talked about what it means for a worker, jobs or tasks, careers or climbing walls. The next big thing for us is looking at companies and what does the org chart become? How do you organize work around it? But in terms of the core of the book, I think it's going to last for decades because it is essentially an articulation and defense of human capability and definition of human capability. And we're only going to get better at being human because of what AI is about to force us to become as workers rather than change who we are as humans. Like we already did that in the industrial age. Mm-hmm. We're going to change back to who we were before at work for so many of us. So like I end by often telling people, think about your family 300 plus years ago, your ancestors, probably in really tough spots, most of us, getting through the day of living, let alone working, with an entrepreneurial mindset. They had to like figure stuff out. They had to try stuff. They had to be resilient, adaptive, imaginative, inventive. Like that's what work is about to become. It's going to go back to some fundamentals. So my hope is the book actually sells more later, is a bigger deal later, as we all get more focused on the human part than anything that was just like a flash of a moment of a thought.
Humans for the win. Anish, really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.